Well, hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and I want to extend a warm welcome to everyone who is joining us here at Happy Hour with Dr. T. We get together two nights a week on Tuesday night and on Thursday nights to have conversations that I really think you'll enjoy because I know how much I enjoy them. And by the responses that we've been getting from our listeners and watchers, I think that you're really enjoying these discussions, too. I want to welcome our listeners back to part three of this special event called The Second Coming of Saturn. This four-part series is a deep dive into a supernatural enemy who has plagued humanity since the beginning of time. Part one, we talked about the rebellion of the Watchers, the connection between the Great Conjunction of 2020, the Great Reset, and the earth-shaking rebellion of the Sons of Gods in chapter six of the book of Genesis. In part two, Derek walked us through the great identities that were worn by the leader of the Watchers' rebellion and gave us a biblically based explanation for why he is Lucifer, but not, say it, Saturn. I'm telling you, if you missed that, you've got to go back and watch it. It will blow your mind. And in fact, if you miss part one and or part two, and if you want to listen to them over again, because there's so much material in there that's just loaded, you can go get directly to drtenpenny.com/Saturn, and you'll be able to see part one and part two on those special events. There's no registration fees. It's free. It's freely available there for you to be able to watch and learn and listen through the end of February. With that, let me introduce you today's special guest and educator for this special event, Derek Gilbert. Derek Gilbert is the host of Daily News Analysis Program 5 in 10 for Skywatch TV. He is also the co-host of Sci-Friday in Unraveling Revelation with his lovely wife, author, and analyst, Sharon Gilbert. The Gilberts began podcasting in 2005, and to date, they have produced more than 1,600 programs on geopolitics and prophecy, which just blows my mind. That is so much content. They also host a weekly Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship. Derek does a podcast with our friend, Doug Van Dorn, called Iron and Myth. All of these are linked together at gilberthouse.org and can be accessed through their very cool app, GHTV. He and Sharon have co-authored multiple books, and Derek's latest book, The Second Coming of Saturn, is what we're discussing here in this four-part series. If you haven't done so already, go to their main website, go to gilberthouse.org, or you can go to Amazon if that's your seller of choice. But you know, if you buy it directly from the author, they make a little bit more money and you're supporting their work instead of supporting the big guys. So go to gilberthouse.org and get a copy so that you can follow along. I'll tell you, this is not light reading, but all the research that is done is in this book is just incredible. So now here in part three, this week is part three, Derek is going to talk to us about the most detestable pagan god in the Bible, Moloch, which was a Hebrew name for the Canaanite god El, known as Saturn. And that's where this whole thing comes together. I know a lot of people start thinking about Saturn from astrology, and they start thinking about, you know, in astrology, they talk about the second return of Saturn. You only get two of those in your lifetime in astrology, and it's usually a big explosive time. Well, it's going to be a big explosive time because of the Canaanite god El, also known as Saturn. Derek is going to show us the evidence linking Moloch to the end times prophecy and to the U.S. Capitol. This series has been so incredible, Derek. Thank you so much back to part three of the special event at Happy Hour with Dr. T.
Oh, Dr. Sherry, it's an honor to be here and really appreciate you using this platform to bring maybe some lesser known ideas that have not been taught in our churches to your audience. I know Doug Van Dorn was one of the first. He wrote the book Giants, Sons of the Gods back in 2013. And we've been following a similar track to Doug. I used his book as a resource, especially when it came to what the early church believed about the origin of giants and the origin of demons and the overlap between what we call mythology, Greek and Roman religion, and the Bible. And I'll show you in today's study that the Greeks actually got the name of their old gods from the Amorites, the Canaanites. So this all fits together.
it all fits together. And I just want to tell our listeners here tonight and our viewers that we did do a four-part series with Doug Van Dorn. In fact, he was right. The one who kicked this whole thing off. You know, we've been doing Happy Hour with Dr. T for going on 3 years. Thursday night's usually my night to lead the Bible study. And he said, well, would you like to take me? So I invited him on our Tuesday night guest night. And he said, would you like to take this a little bit deeper? I don't think I really got to cover as much as I would like to. And I can do a four-part series for you. And we thought, that's really cool. We can change things up a little bit for our listeners and our watchers, that we're doing something a little bit different. And like you said, bringing forth deeper concepts that you can't really do in an hour interview. And so Doug did a four-part series. And then Doug Woodward did a four-part series called Heavenly Hosts and Gospel Truths. And we did that through the month of December. And we were so grateful that you said yes to do this part that we're doing in January. And I think we're pretty close. I'll announce this to our listeners. We haven't 100% locked this down, but I think the month of February, we're going to do a four-part series with L.A. Marzulli.
Oh, wonderful.
And that would just be explosive, the stuff and putting all of these things together. And you can find these on a tab. You can find Derek's at drtenpenny.com/Saturn. So why don't you go ahead and get started with us tonight? Because I know you've got so much to share.
Yeah, there's a lot in this week. Last week, we covered some of the identities worn by Saturn, as he was known to the Romans, and explained why I believe in Isaiah 14, the reference to Lucifer in Hebrew, Halel ben Shachar, is actually a reference to Enlil, which is the Akkadian and Babylonian identity worn by Saturn of the Romans, Kronos of the Greeks. This entity, who according to Peter and Jude, is in the abyss, in the bottomless pit, in Tartarus, specifically according to Peter, which suggests that maybe God thinks he's even more dangerous than Satan, because Satan is still roaming about as a lion seeking whom he may devour. He still had access to the throne room of God. He doesn't get thrown down until Revelation 12, which was the time of the birth of Jesus. Revelation 12, when Michael throws the seven-headed dragon, the red dragon, Satan, out of heaven. So he's still free and moving about, whereas this entity that we're discussing over this four-week period, called Saturn by the Romans, I believe Shemayaza, the leader of the rebellion of the sons of God, described very briefly in Genesis chapter 6. And there's another identity that we'll get to in the end times in our fourth part of this series, because he didn't go away. He's not, he still has a role to play in the end times. But this week, we'll talk about the connection between Molech and this entity, and the Mount of Olives, and then the connection to the Capitol Hill here in the United States.
Amazing.
Molech is based on the Hebrew consonants mem, lamed, and I'm showing off my lack of understanding of Hebrew. But in English, it would be the consonants MLK. Okay, and because Hebrew is a consonantal language, no vowels in the ancient form. Before they started adding diacritical markings to indicate which vowels are supposed to be used, you have to look at the context to determine whether they mean Molech, this entity of the underworld who demanded child sacrifice, the word Melech, which means king, or Malach, which means messenger angel. Okay, you have to look at the context. For example, in Isaiah chapter 59, verse 9, there's a reference there to the king in our English Bibles, but I think it's actually a reference to Molech, this underworld entity. In the English translation, it reads, you journeyed to the king with oil and multiplied your perfumes. You sent your envoys far off and sent down even to Sheol. Now, Sheol is the equivalent of Hades, the underworld, where the dead reside. But because we're dealing with this underworld entity, and Isaiah 57 is in the context of offering sacrifices to the dead, in other words, the spirits of the giants destroyed in the flood, demons, it makes more sense to read it, you journeyed to Molech with oil and multiplied your perfumes, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I'm referring to here. We've got to read in context. Sometimes when the Bible translates king, the context suggests that it's actually dealing with this entity. But the word really does mean king, or is based on king, Melech. The Hebrews changed it and made it a pejorative by swapping the vowels Molech, the same way they took Baal and changed it to Bosheth to mean, instead of Lord, to mean shameful thing. The Hebrews turned it into a pejorative. We see Molech in the Bible. He's one of the most mysterious entities of the ancient world. There are some scholars who actually tried to reinterpret the MLK as the name of the sacrifice rather than the name of the entity. But it's pretty good. There's pretty good evidence that this was an entity of the underworld worshipped in the ancient world. He was known from texts at the northern Syrian city-state of Ebla from about 2500 BC. This is 500 or 600 years before Abraham. I mean, think about 2,500 years ago for us. That was about the time Nebuchadnezzar was, you know, or the Israelites were starting to come back from Babylon. All right. That's how much time had passed between the birth of Jesus and the oldest known reference to this entity. He was called Malik in the Ebla texts, but scholars are pretty sure they're dealing with the same entity, a god of the underworld. He was served by minions called Maliku, which appear to be connected in some of the ancient pagan texts with the Rephaim, spirits of the netherworld. In the Bible, he was condemned by Moses. This is around 1400 BC, the book of Leviticus, in Leviticus chapter 20, where God very specifically says, anyone who gives any of his children to Molech shall surely be put to death. What's interesting, though, is that in this reference and in another passage in Deuteronomy 18, there's a connection drawn by God to sacrificing children to Molech, to then turning to mediums, the Ovoth, which refers back to that necromantic ritual pit I mentioned in our first week, the Ov, which we can trace back through the ancient Hurrian people to the plain of Ararat, where, you know, the lowlands below where Noah landed the ark. Mediums and necromancers, those who summon the spirits of the dead. In other words, there's a connection between this prohibition against worshiping Molech, i.e. Saturn, and summoning the spirits of the dead. Don't sacrifice your children. It's connected to this practice of summoning demonic spirits and asking them for information. It's odd, but that is the case. After the prohibition against burning children as offerings, there were seven specific activities forbidden by God, Deuteronomy 18, verses 10 through 12, all described as an abomination to the Lord, and all of them are intended to gain information from the spirit realm. There's some connection between the sacrifice of children and summoning spirits from the spirit realm, demonic spirits, which, as the early church understood, as the apostles understood, were the spirits of the giants, the Nephilim destroyed in the flood of Noah. Why that is connected, I don't know, but it's right here when you read into the scripture with the worldview of the apostles and the prophets.
You know, there are several verses that I've read in the Bible, and I'm sure there's many more that I haven't read yet, that talk about prohibition of astrologers, about seeking, you know, and I think astrologers are, you know, talking to other angels and, you know, other gods and things like that, rather than listening for the voice of the Lord directly himself. Right. And I'll bet you that if you look at the Hebrew portion of that, or even the Greek, there's probably something that talks about summoning the dead and talking to other, not just saying, oh, let's just talk to your angels and your spirit guides, but there is something a little bit more nefarious that goes along with that.
Yeah. And this is a practice that's forbidden all the way through the Bible. It's what's interesting is that it's only been about the last 40 years or so that scholars have reached a consensus that, yes, there was a cult of the dead. And again, whenever we say the dead, we'll put that in air quotes because, yeah, they were dead, but the demonic spirits that were contacted by humans were not the spirits of the ancestors, but the spirits of these. Because the only time we see in the Bible any hint that a human spirit can come back and interact with the living is when Samuel is summoned by the Ov of Endor, the medium of Endor, or the owner of the ritual pit of Endor, but that was by special dispensation. God had a special message to deliver to Saul, and he used the spirit of Samuel to do it. But normally, human spirits don't hang around on earth waiting to fulfill unfinished business or something like that. The spirits that are here that are in contact with the mediums and the necromancers are the spirits of these entities destroyed in the flood, the hybrid spirits of the giants.
And that's again, really important.
That was the consensus view of the early church for the first 400 years after the resurrection of Jesus. We kind of lost that over the last 1600 years. So this was, again, intimately connected, specifically connected in Leviticus 20 and Deuteronomy 18 with the practice of child sacrifice. Deuteronomy 18 again says, there shall not be found among you anyone who burns her son or daughter as an offering to Molech, anyone who practices divination or tells fortunes or omens or interprets omens, or a sorcerer or a charmer or a medium or a necromancer or one who inquires of the dead, or whoever does these, for whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord. And again, those seven specific things that were called an abomination connected to child sacrifice, and all seven of those things, divination, fortune telling, inquiring of the dead, summoning the dead, connected to summoning spirits from the spirit realm for the purpose of getting information. Now, again, the similarity of Molech, the name of this entity, and Melech, the Hebrew word for king, is not coincidental. A scholar about 10 years ago did something really, I think, really smart. He went through the Onomasticon, that's the catalog of names collected through texts found from the ancient kingdom of Ammon. This is centered around where today is Ammon, the capital of the country of Jordan. It was a small kingdom east of the Jordan River, and their national god was Milcom. And the Bible tells us, by describing him as the abomination of the Ammonites, Milcom and Molech were one and the same, just different pronunciations of the same term. Well, this scholar said, you know, in the ancient world, here was his thought process. Names had what are called theophoric elements, or a God element to each name, like Hezekiah or Ezekiel. It's a reference to a deity who is worshipped by the people who named their child that way. So you see in Akkadian and Babylonian, you see references to kings with a name like Shamshi-Adad, which is the name of the storm god, or Eshmi Dagon, you know, the Dagon being another one of these identities worn by Saturn. The point is that almost all names in the ancient world, in the biblical period, especially in the Old Testament, had a theophoric element, a god name. So this scholar said, okay, if Milcom is the chief god of the country of Ammon, the kingdom of Ammon, that should be the most popular theophoric element among all of these names that we've discovered from these texts. But turns out that's not the case. The most popular theophoric element for the kingdom of Ammon was Elu, which is their form of El, the Canaanite creator god. El, one of the identities worn by Saturn, Kronos, El, Dagon, Enlil, Molech, etc. So Milcom was just the title they gave to El. In other words, they just called him king. And the Hebrews, understanding that that's what their neighbors, their pagan neighbors, called their chief god, king, which is really hubris, because there is only one king in the spirit realm, and that is Yahweh, the God of the Bible, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They changed it to Molech, and again, turned it into an insult, a pejorative. So we come down 400 years after Moses to the time of Solomon. Solomon, according to 1 Kings 11, verses 4 through 7, built a high place on the Mount of Olives for Milcom. Also two other deities, Chemosh, the national god of Moab, and Astarte, who was the one of the chief deities of the Phoenicians. But because of this, the priests referred to the Mount of Olives as the Mount of Corruption, the Mount of Corruption. Now, bear in mind that the Mount of Olives is east of the Temple Mount. Solomon built the Temple of Yahweh, the Temple of God, on the Temple Mount. The doors to the temple open to the east. So you look out from the temple, you look up 200 feet because the Mount of Olives is taller, and up there you see a temple for Molech.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Solomon, convinced by one of his foreign wives, probably a princess of Ammon, to build this high place. And because of this, this was referred to as the Mount of Corruption. But, you know, again, as I demonstrated earlier, I don't speak or read Hebrew or pronounce it very well either. But I do have electronic tools that I can use to help me. And the Hebrew translated in our English Bibles as the Mount of Corruption. This is in 2 Kings 23, verse 13. Is har, which means mountain, ha mashkit. Well, the word ha is the definite article the, so it's mount of the something. But in English, it's translated mount of corruption. Well, wait, where's the definite article the, mount of the corruption? When you do a word search for ha mashkit, you find there's a reference to it, references to it elsewhere in scripture. It actually means the destroyer, mount of the destroyer And I ran this past our friend, Messianic Rabbi Zev Porat, and also had the chance to ask this of Jonathan Kahn, Rabbi Jonathan Kahn, when he visited Skywatch TV. I said, have you heard of this? Does this make sense to you? He said, well, yeah, that's a valid translation. Never thought of that before. So keep this in the back of your mind, because this will be important next week. We come back to Mount of the Destroyer. This location on the Mount of Olives is where Jesus was crucified. And I go into this in some depth in the book, The Second Coming of Saturn, the evidence pointing to the Mount of Olives as the place where he was crucified. He was betrayed in Gethsemane. And the Gospel of John says he was crucified in the garden where he was betrayed. And then the tomb in which he was laid was in that garden as well. It was called Golgotha, which we're told is translated as the place of a skull. And scholars for 2,000 years, Christians have been trying to find the exact location for 2,000 years by looking for a stone or something shaped like a skull. But the actual Greek word is crania, which means just the brain pan, the top of the skull. So what we're looking for is the top of the Mount of Olives where Jesus was crucified. Hmm. It's been a place of worship for a long time. David, when he was fleeing from Absalom, stopped on the summit of the Mount of Olives, and 2 Samuel 15, 30 and 32, we're told that that's where God was worshiped. But the word translated God there is El, where El was worshiped. Again, in context, it could be one or the other. The point, though, was that the summit of the Mount of Olives in Hebrew is the word Rosh, as in Rosh Hashanah, head of the year, the new year, or Rosh, the chief prince of meaning the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal in Ezekiel 38 and 39. It's not a reference to Russia. It means the head, the top of the head. That's where Jesus was crucified. Well, Jesus, during his life, paid special attention to the Mount of Olives. In fact, the final week of his life, he essentially divided his time between teaching in the temple on the Temple Mount and teaching on the Mount of Olives. Now, even before this final week of his life, that's where he raised Lazarus from the dead. Okay, now bear in mind, again, this was the location of the Temple of Molech in the days of Solomon, 900 years before the birth of Jesus. Solomon had built this high place there, leading priests to call it Mount of the Destroyer. So Jesus goes to Bethany. He raises Lazarus from the dead there, Bethany on the southeast slope of the Mount of Olives. He obtained the donkey for his triumphal entry into Jerusalem at Bethphage, which is on the eastern slope of the Mount of Olives. And the donkey, as his ride into Jerusalem, was really significant because in the ancient Near East, soldiers rode horses, kings rode donkeys.
Wow.
This is a very old tradition. We've got this documented in an Amorite text from a king of a city called Mari on the Euphrates River. It's near the modern border between Syria and Iraq. King Zimri Lim was told by one of his assistants, my king should honor his kingship by riding a donkey, essentially. So even as late, and this was in the time of Abraham, but even in, down to the time of Jesus, 1800 years later, it was still known, the symbolism of what he did by riding into Jerusalem on a donkey. The king has arrived. And he made that journey from the Mount of Olives, where the temple, the high place to Molech had been.
Wow.
Jesus gave the Olivet Discourse on the Mount of Olives. This is why it's called the Olivet Discourse, of course. This was his longest and most detailed teaching on what would happen in the end times, given right there on the Mount of Olives. Matthew 24 and 25, Mark 13, Luke 21. This is where he says, you know, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Right there on this mountain where Molech had put a temple that looked down on the temple of God. He was arrested in Gethsemane. He was crucified on the mount. Now, I know the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is supposed to be the traditional location. That's in the Christian quarter of the old city of Jerusalem. I'm sorry, but when Helena, the mother of Emperor Constantine, went there in the fourth century, some enterprising guy said, oh, yeah, we've got the true cross right over here. And, oh, yeah, here's the place. Sorry, no. Book of Hebrews says Jesus was executed outside the gate, meaning it was outside the city of Jerusalem. John 19, verse 20, the site was near the city, outside the walls. It was on the Mount of Olives. Dr. N.F. Hutchinson wrote extensively about this. For the Palestine Exploration Fund in 1873, went into some real deep a real deep dive into the evidence. And I summarize that in the book, The Second Coming of Saturn. He was crucified on the Mount of Olives, Golgotha, the place of a skull. The question, whose skull are we talking about here? I mentioned our friend Rabbi Zev Porat earlier. He'll be with us on our tour of Israel coming up in March, and he will show us the location. He did back in 2019 when we went there. The actual historic crucifixion site is now a parking lot.
You mentioned that, and I was going to bring that up about, you've done a lot of tours in Israel, right?
Well, just two.
Just two. Yeah. I know there are a lot of other tour people that go to Israel. So what do they tell people when they say, oh, this is really where, like all those things that you just said really aren't the historical places? Is that super misleading to what the truth is about where the crucifixion actually was?
Well, I don't know, because the two times we've gone with Lipkin Tours, Aaron and Eddie Lipkin, who live in Samaria, what the world calls the West Bank. They're very interested in archaeology and history and Orthodox Jews, but they become dear friends of ours. And they are very, very warm and receiving of Christians and happy to go where we ask them. So when Zev said, I'd like to stop at the parking lot across the street from the Church of the Paternoster on the Mount of Olives, they said, sure, whatever you like. It's your tour. And so they allow us to do these teachings there. Now, what more traditional tours do, honestly, I don't know. I'm sure they go to visit the Church of the Holy Sepulchre because for 2,000 years almost, or 1,700 years anyway, that's been the traditional spot where Jesus was crucified and buried. But when we look at the evidence in Scripture, even Roman law dictates that a rebel, an insurrectionist, if you forgive the term, is to be executed on the spot where he was arrested. And we know he was arrested at Gethsemane, which is on the Mount of Olives. So taking all of these things into account, we don't have any problem sharing this. And the tour guides from Lipkin Tours, they're happy to allow us to do it. When we go to Megiddo, for example, we'll say, look, far be it from us to criticize the Israeli National Park Authority, but this is not where Armageddon will be fought. Contrary to what the sign says over here, which again is based on tradition, Megiddo is not the site of Armageddon. And I'll explain why, by the way, before we're done with this four-part series. So we want to show the actual battle sites in this long supernatural war in our tours. And I won't say we've got everything correct. We probably have some things wrong. But when we're speculating, we'll say that we're speculating, and we'll at least give the reasons why we believe what we believe. So, when we go back to Capernaum, we'll explain why that's so significant. Why did Jesus choose to base his ministry there? Why is Jesus walking on the water and stilling the storm even more significant? I mean, yes, pretty spectacular miracles, but even more significant from a spiritual, supernatural standpoint than we've been taught.
So, wow.
The Mount of Olives, again, this is one of those things that just shows that again and again, where Jesus did certain things is just as important as what he did. Because again, Jesus betrayed on the Mount of Olives, arrested on the Mount of Olives, crucified on the Mount of Olives. Of course, I started down this rabbit trail, but let me finish the point. Whose skull? Rabbi Zev Porat believes that Golgotha refers to the skull of Goliath.
Oh.
Because we read in 1 Samuel 17 that David brought the head of Goliath with him to Jerusalem and may have buried it on the summit of the Mount of Olives. Hence the name, place of a skull, the place of Goliath's skull. So, but Jesus, again, during the final week of his life, taught on the Mount of Olives, the Olivet Discourse. Here's what's going to happen for the rest of history. Hey, are you listening down there, Molech? Betrayed, crucified, buried on the Mount of Olives, descended into the abyss. 1 Peter 3, verses 18 through 20. Christ suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison, because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah. These spirits that he's proclaiming to are not human spirits. In fact, the Greek term translated spirit is never used of human spirits in the New Testament unless it is qualified as such. He was proclaiming victory over the spirits in the abyss, the ones referred to in 2 Peter 2, verse 4, and in Jude, verses 6 and 7. So the very entity who led the rebellion, who then was worshipped by followers, even though he's in the abyss, as Milcom, Molech, Enlil, El, Dagon, Asher, Saturn, Kronos, Baal, Haman, Jesus went down from the Mount of Olives, where his temple was built by Solomon, the temple for Milcom slash Molech, and declared victory over them. And of course, he was resurrected on the Mount of Olives, because that's where he was first seen by the women who approached the tomb. And then he ascended into heaven, according to Luke 24, verses 50 and 51. He ascended into heaven from Bethany on the Mount of Olives. And of course, Zechariah 14, verse 4 says, when he returns, he lands on the Mount of Olives and splits it in half.
Wow.
So do you think maybe he was sending a message? I think so, because nothing is done by coincidence. So we'll come back to this and what happens in the last days, the prophetic significance of this, before we're all done with this study. That'll be next week. The other identities worn by this creature, Shemiyaza in ancient times, we've gone through the others, Enlil, Asher, Dagon, El. We'll deal with the ones from the Christian era now. Kronos, the chief god, or at least the chief of the old gods, the Titans of the Greek religion. He was the youngest of the gods, born to Mother Earth, Gaia, by the sky god Uranus, led the rebellion against Uranus and castrated his father with a sickle. This is very similar to the story told by the ancient Hurrians of their equivalent of Kronos, named Kumarbi, who likewise castrated his father, the sky god Anu. Not a coincidence, the older version is the Hurrian version. And again, those are the people that we can trace back through their pottery to the plains of Ararat below the mountain where the ark came to rest. This connection between the Greek belief about their old gods and the sons of God described in Genesis chapter 6 was known to Jewish religious scholars in the Septuagint translation of the Bible, which was translated by 70 Jewish religious scholars about 200 years before the birth of Jesus. They connected the idea that these old gods or spirit beings or angels, if you will, who created giants, they translate the word Rephaim in Proverbs 21, verse 16, Job's 26, verse 5. The word Rephaim is translated into Greek as gigantes, giants. In Proverbs 2, verse 8, Rephaim, translated as earthborn. Earthborn because the Titans, these old deities of the Greek religion, now banished to Tartarus, just like the sons of God, rebellious angels mentioned by Peter and Jude, were born of Mother Earth, Gaia. She was the mother of the Titans. And again, this was the understanding of the early church. The early church fathers, Justin Martyr, Irenaeus, Athenagoras, Origen, Pseudo-Clement, Eusebius, and others all understood that giants were the hybrid children of these fallen sons of God, called watchers in the book of First Enoch, and human women, and that their spirits became demons after their death. This was Christianity 101 in the first four centuries after the resurrection. In fact, Irenaeus, one of the most brilliant of the early church theologians, speculated that the name of Antichrist would be Titan.
Wow.
Which, yes. Now, he spelled it T-E-I-T-A-N, but he gave his reasons for it. And he said that numerologically, you know, using gematria, the numeric equivalent of the letters in that name added up to 666. But to his credit, Irenaeus went on to say, but look, if it was important that we knew the name, the one to whom the revelation was given, meaning John, who wrote the book of Revelation, the Holy Spirit would have revealed it to John and told him to write it down. So Irenaeus is saying, here's my best guess, but let's not get hung up on this. So
why do they, one of the questions that I've always had is, why did they call themselves, or why were they called the Watchers?
Because they were given charge, I believe, of administering humanity, watching over humanity. What's interesting is that the Hebrew word that means watcher, ear, is identical to the word that means city. So, and it's the same in Hebrew as it is in Aramaic. The book of Daniel, chapter 4, there are mention of watchers who descend in a dream of King Nebuchadnezzar. And he's told by these watchers, who are also called holy ones, that his punishment for his pride had been decreed by the watchers, which means that not all of the watchers are rebellious, that there are watchers that are still loyal to God, because they're the ones who were charged with and decreed the punishment of Nebuchadnezzar for his basically daring to compare himself with the creator of the universe. But it may have something to do with the fact that when you had a city, you put walls around it, and you had to have watchers on the walls to keep an eye out for enemies. That may be the case, except in a planetary sense. You know, after the Tower of Babel incident, when God divided the nations, according to Deuteronomy 32, verses 8 and 9, when God divided the nations, he numbered them according to the number of the B'nai HaElohim, the number of the sons of God. And it was the understanding of the Jewish religious scholars of Jesus' day and the early church that there were angels who had been delegated responsibility for watching over humanity, but they fell. They were tempted into sinning. As Sharon describes it in her supernatural series of novels, The Red Wing Saga, it was a test and a trap. I mean, God knew what was going to happen. He sees the end from the beginning, but he still created us all with free will. It's just that he is outside of time, so he's seeing everything at once. He's not just everywhere, he's every when.
And these oh, that's good. That's a I've not heard that before, but that's accurate. That's really good.
Yeah, but we're all, you know, experiencing time in a linear fashion.
Yes.
So for us, our choices, you know, we've got the free will to choose to obey or disobey, and apparently the angelic realm created the same way. So again, that was what happened after that first generation, if you will, of and maybe that's the wrong term, but after the first batch of angels, for lack of a better term, sinned prior to the flood of Noah and created these hybrid giants, the Nephilim, they were sent down to the abyss. Peter, again, is specific in placing them in Tartarus, a level of the netherworld below Hades, reserved for supernatural threats to the divine order of things. But God then, after Babel, which was an attempt to build an artificial mountain as an abode of the gods, God delegated another group of sons of God to administer earth. Essentially, and I think I mentioned this example last week or the week before, but it's similar to the way when the Israelites demanded a king, God said, okay, just telling Samuel, you know, tell the Israelites you'll have a king, but you're not going to like it. And the same thing was, the situation was similar after Babel. You want the gods to dwell with you? Okay, I'll let you have it, but you're not going to like it. And of course, that's where, to this day, in fact, the rabbis that believe in the existence of other spirit beings believe that the nations of the world other than Israel are controlled by these angels, and that the angels of the nations will be judged after the war of Gog and Magog. That's Jewish eschatology. It's close to being correct, not quite, but it's close. These would be the spirits that we would call, say, Satan and some of the other entities that are influencing the world today, like Inanna or Ishtar, the gender fluid god / goddess of sex and war. We believe they are still active in the world to this day.
Well, look
these
around.
Are the ones, yeah.
You know.
These are the ones who were given some authority and responsibility over the world after the Tower of Babel. This entity we're talking about here today, Saturn, Kronos, Baal Hamon, Molech, Shemayaza, still influences the world to this day. And you know, I'll talk about the evidence for that here in a little bit. But continuing on with, here's the thing that I stumbled onto, a couple of things, actually, as I was researching Kronos, the king of the Titans, who, you know, if anyone's seen like Clash of the Titans or Wrath of the Titans, mm-hmm. Kronos was the evil guy. Kids that have read the Percy Jackson and the Olympians series, Kronos is like the evil monster they want to keep confined to the netherworld. Kronos was known as one who accepted human sacrifice, and specifically the sacrifice of children, just like Molech. Of course, according to the Greek stories, when he had overthrown Uranus and castrated him, Uranus and Gaia gave him a prophecy that one of his children would overthrow him someday. So as his children were born, and these were the Olympians, Cronos took them from his wife Rhea and swallowed them. This happened six times until Rhea finally caught on that there was a pattern and substituted a rock for Zeus, who was the youngest. And when Zeus was born, Cronos ate that rock. Zeus was raised in secret on the island of Crete. When he became fully grown, he led the rebellion, and Cronos and the Titans were banished to Tartarus, to the netherworld. Now, that's the fake news version of what happened with the Watchers, the sons of God from Genesis chapter 6, who are, according to Peter, in Tartarus. But because of this idea that Cronos was accepting of the sacrifice of children, I mean, he ate his own kids, he actually had a nickname or an epithet in the ancient world. And there's a Greek inscription that was found referring to him as Cronos Technophagos, which means Cronos, the child eater. That's who this entity is. The Saturnalia, which is the most popular of the Roman annual festivals, it's the one that's held between the 17th and 23rd of December every year in ancient Rome, was actually based on an older festival celebrated by the Greeks called the Cronia. The Greeks celebrated an older form of the Saturnalia called the Cronia. It was in August instead of in December, but there's evidence that this is based on an even older festival celebrated by the Hittites and the Hurrians for their version of this entity named Kumarbi. Again, This is a very, very old cult, if you will, that has managed to sustain itself for, just according to the written texts that we can document, more than 5,000 years. And it's just gone through various phases as languages have changed, as cultures have changed, as the center of geopolitical power on Earth have changed. Here's one of the things that I just really blew my mind. The name Titan. Scholars have been trying to figure out where the Greeks got the name Titan and have never really come up with a convincing etymology until the last 20 years or so, when a scholar named Amar Anus, who I think I mentioned in a previous program, he's from Estonia, brilliant. He pointed out that the Amorites, who were essentially the Canaanites, the Amorites who dominated the ancient Near East, the lands of the Bible during the time of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, from like 2000 BC to 1500 BC, the Amorites dominated what is now Israel, Jordan, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon. You know, that was an Amorite, it was an Amorite world, various kingdoms and all, but they were all Amorites. There was a tribe of Amorite prior to the time of Abraham, about 2300 BC, the first time they show up in history, called the Tidanu. They were so scary that the last Sumerian kings who ruled Mesopotamia, the third dynasty of the city-state of Ur, built a wall 175 miles long north of modern-day Baghdad. And the point of this wall was to keep the Tidanu out of southern Iraq, keep them out of their kingdom. And we know this because the texts that have been discovered name the wall as the Amorite wall that keeps the Tidanu away.
Wow.
Except that it didn't, and they overran the kingdom around 2004 BC or somewhere around there. Anyway, that name is based on the Akkadian word for bull or aurochs, which is an ancient strain of cattle that's now extinct. They stood like 6 foot at the shoulder, the bulls. Huge. This was where that name of that tribe came from. And by the time of the judges in Israel, around 1200 BC, they were believed to be a collection of spirits in the netherworld called the Council of the Tidanu. And kings of the Amorites, when they died, wanted to join this assembly, the Council of the Tidanu. They were sort of like a middle-tier deity between the great gods like Baal and humanity. And this is where the Greeks got their name for their old gods banished to the netherworld, the Titans. It came from the name of this ancient Amorite tribe, the Tidanu. And what's interesting is that the name, meaning bull or ox or aurochs, is significant when you consider that the name Cronos, the king of the Titans, his name derives from the Semitic word karnu, which means horns.
Oh, wow.
The horned one. The Canaanite version of Cronos, El, his main nickname was Bull El. So there's this connection between, well, shall we say bovid imagery, bulls, and, you know, and when you look at the protective deities that stood outside the gates of the palace in ancient Assyria, the palace at Nineveh, these giant winged bull-like things with human heads. Sharon and I had the opportunity to see two of them at the British Museum that had been taken there back in the 19th century when the site of ancient Nineveh was found. You see these giant bull creatures, about 20 feet tall, winged bulls, human head, but when you look closely at what should be the hooves of the bull, they're actually lion's paws. Well, that's the cherubim, human, ox, eagle, and lion in the Assyrian Lamassu, these protective deities that were supposed to guard the king in the ancient world.
Wow.
Well, those are the guardian creatures around the throne in the book of Revelation, in the book of Ezekiel. That's exactly who you're dealing with. Cherubim. Wow. Yeah, the cherubim were not these chubby little babies with wings, you know, like we see in the medieval paintings. That is so wrong. That's who we're dealing with here. And again, this connects to the bovid imagery or bull-like imagery connected to Kronos, Bull El, and the Titans in general. The Phoenicians called this entity Baal Haman. He also was known for child sacrifice. We visited one of the Tophets. We see a reference to the Tophet in the Valley of Hinnom or Gehenna in the Bible, but there was one on the island of Sardinia where the Phoenicians had a trading post set. And it also at the site of ancient Carthage, which was the most powerful of the Phoenician kingdoms in the classical era of history. You remember Hannibal almost overthrew Rome, almost destroyed Rome in the long Punic War between Rome and Carthage. They found thousands of infants who were basically sacrificed and burned.
Where did they get this crazy idea about burning children as a sacrifice to the gods? Where did that kind of come from?
You know, I can only speculate because scholars don't have a definite answer for this. In fact, scholars are still arguing that, oh no, these are children who just died of natural causes. It's like, no, there are scholars who have done mathematical analyses on this and found that the probability of this many children dying between a certain age, like, you know, like 4 months and 12 months or whatever the ages were, is just highly unlikely. They were sacrificed and burned. I think it goes back to what happened to the children of these entities of Baal Haman, Kronos, Saturn, Molech, Shemiyaza. They were confined in the abyss during the 150 days that Noah's Ark was on the water. You know, 5 months exactly in a lunar calendar, 5 30-day months, while their children, the Nephilim, were destroyed in the flood. So I think this is their way of exacting revenge on humanity by trying to destroy the children of Adam and Eve.
Hmm.
And in fact, we look at, I think that's what it is.
Then why didn't they want them to be drowned as opposed to like burned? You know, because I've read some things about these ceremonies that they did, like at the equinox, you know, at the spring and the winter equinox, and they were the gods sacrificed the children to the gods in like a big orgy in the spring, and then it would be 9 months later, you know, when the babies would be born, that they would be they would do that in the fall, and then they would sacrifice the babies in the spring, which would be the planting season, to try to ensure a good harvest from their planting season in the spring. And these were all the babies that were born from these big orgies that were happening in the fall of sacrificing to these gods. I don't remember where I was reading this, but they were talking about how there was these drum beats, like these biennial drums that would get them all kind of, you know, keyed up, and that the drums would be so loud and that people would be screaming so loud because of the sexual orgies to overcome the sound of the babies screaming as they were burning to death.
Yeah.
Impulsive stuff.
The Greek and Roman historians who wrote about the Carthaginian practice, the Phoenician practice, said that they would even, that the wealthy among the Carthaginians would buy children from the poorer members of their society to offer as a substitute for their own children.
Wow.
And that the poor mother who watched her child being sacrificed was not allowed to show any emotion, because if she showed any emotion, she wouldn't get paid.
Mm.
So now why they did this way, the sacrifice and the burning rather than the drowning, honestly, I don't know. I don't think scholars have figured that out either. I've done a lot of reading on this. There are entire books that have been written about Molech, digging into what have been found archaeologically, but also what the classical historians from Greece and Rome have written about the Carthaginians. And we just don't know.
It's amazing that they've got that kind of information because of Carthage being destroyed down to ashes, you know, that they just, you know, that, and so it had to have been things that were created and written and stored somewhere prior to that destruction, correct?
Well, yeah. The Tophets, they were able to excavate and find the burial sites of all of these children. But again, we got the writings of some of the early church fathers and some of the, for example, Tertullian, who wrote, since Saturn did not spare his own children, again, you know, version of Cronus, ate his children as they were born, of course, he stuck to his habit of not sparing those of other people. This was Tertullian. But there were, you know, Greek historians as well that were writing about what the Phoenicians were up to. There was a case in, I think, the 4th century BC where Carthage was surprised. They were at war with the ruler of Syracuse, which was a city-state on the island of Sicily. And the tyrant of Sicily, and that was just a term for the guy who was like the ruler of the city-state, took them by surprise. They woke up one morning and found that their city, Carthage, was surrounded by a Greek army. And they decided it was because the wealthy had been buying these substitute sacrifices to replace their own children. So in order to appease Baal Haman, Cronos, Saturn, El, Molech, they slaughtered hundreds of kids all at once. Like, all these kids that should have been sacrificed, let's do it now. And that'll make Cronos, Baal Haman happy. And it was horrific. It was horrific.
Wow. Wow.
So how does this entity still influence the world to this day? I would just point to the number of children sacrificed last year on planet Earth. The number one cause of death on Earth for the last several years running is abortion.
Abortion.
43 million lives ended through abortion in 2022. That's more than triple the number of deaths from all communicable diseases combined, including COVID-19, HIV, AIDS, not even close.
And is that a global number?
That is a global number, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, 43 million killed around the world in 2022. I also get into the book, and I don't have time to do it here, explaining why Saturnalia was not the origin of Christmas, but just let's set that to rest. Saturnalia was not the origin of Christmas, and we can go into that in some depth in the book or maybe on another program at some time. But very briefly, before we jump into the future fulfillment of a prophecy, the return of Saturn, hence the name of the book, The Second Coming of Saturn, I want to bring up a prophecy or a poem that is interpreted as prophecy by occult adepts, New Agers. And this gets back to what I talked about in the very first session about the great conjunction, the meeting of Saturn and Jupiter in the night sky on the winter solstice of 2020. A Roman poet by the name of Virgil in the first century BC, he was a contemporary of Julius Caesar, his nephew Octavian, who became Augustus Caesar. He wrote a poem called the Fourth Eclogue. And from this, we get this idea that Saturn ruled over a golden age. He drew on the idea of the four ages of man. This came from the Greek poet Hesiod, who wrote in the 7th century BC, about the time of the prophet Isaiah, that there was a golden age followed by a silver age, a bronze age, and an iron age. And if that sounds like Daniel's prophecy of the statue, mm-hmm. You're right. You know, Daniel was not long after Hesiod. Now, I'm not saying he was influenced by Hesiod, but it's not a coincidence that this pagan poet was influenced to create this alternative explanation for the prophecy of Daniel and the four ages, a golden, silver, bronze, and iron age, the iron to be the final age of the eon. This fourth eclogue written about the year 40 BC, and I'll just summarize very quickly some of the money quotes. Now the last age by Cumae's Sibyl sung. And she was a prophetess who was hugely influential on the Roman Republic and then the Roman Empire. The Last Age by Kumei's Sybil Sung has come and gone, and the majestic roll of circling centuries begins anew. Justice returns old Saturn's reign with a new breed of men sent down from heaven.
Mm.
And then it goes on, and here's the other interesting passage. He, meaning this prophesied child who would initiate this golden age, he shall receive the life of gods and see heroes. And in the ancient world, to the Greeks and the Romans, a hero was a demigod, half human, half divine. In other words, by definition, one of the Nephilim. He shall receive the life of gods and see heroes with gods commingling, and himself be seen of them, and with his father's worth reign o'er a world at peace. Now, Virgil probably wrote this as a political piece for one of his sponsors, but this was taken as prophecy by, well, again, occultists and New Agers throughout the centuries. Charles Thomson, who was Secretary of the Continental Congress here in the United States between 1774 and 1789, designed the Great Seal of the United States, and he placed the Latin phrase Novus Ordo Seclorum on the back, on the seal. That's New Order of the Ages. This was drawn specifically from Virgil's poem, a loose adaptation of the phrase Magnus ab integro seclorum nascitur ordo, the majestic roll of circling centuries begins anew. Anyway, that's where Novus Ordo Seclorum comes from. It comes from Virgil's fourth eclogue, this poem about Saturn returning to rule over a new golden age.
Wow.
Well, fast forward to 1935, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his vice president, Henry Wallace, both of them 32nd degree Scottish Rite Freemasons, decided to add the Great Seal of the United States to the back of the dollar bill. Now, you got two aspects of it. The front is the shield with the eagle on it. The other is the unfinished pyramid with the all-seeing eye on top. And Wallace said, okay, here's the great design. But originally, they had the front side, which is the eagle with the shield on the left and the unfinished pyramid on the right. And FDR, Roosevelt, insisted that they be reversed so that the unfinished pyramid, the reverse of the seal, is on the left. And because we English speakers read left to right, it's kind of assumed when you look at the back of the dollar bill that that's the one that's more important.
Wow.
That unfinished pyramid with the all-seeing eye has never been used on any official U.S. government document. It's always the front side of the seal, but the reverse was given the place of prominence at the insistence of 32nd degree Freemason Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Why? According to Henry Wallace in 1934, This represents the grand architect and the all-seeing eye. Eventually, when the United States took its place among the nations as leadership of this new age, that the grand architect of the universe would finally fit that missing piece, the capstone with the all-seeing eye on top of that pyramid, saying, and he wrote that it will take a more definite recognition of the grand architect of the universe before the apex stone, that capstone with the all-seeing eye, is finally fitted into place and this nation in the full strength of its power is in position to assume leadership among the nations in inaugurating the new order of
wow.
the ages. He saw it as fulfilling prophecy. And I know we're getting close on time here, but very quickly, I think this is built into the art and architecture of the United States Capitol, which by the way is called the Capitol because that's the name of the temple of Jupiter, i.e. Baal, i.e. Satan, in Rome, the Capitolium.
Oh, wow.
Thomas Jefferson insisted that it be called the Capitol for that reason. Now, it wasn't that Jefferson was a Jupiter worshiper or anything, but he saw this as a new Rome, a new Roman Republic, and so he wanted the Capitol to be named for that temple, for the chief deity of Rome. The hill on which the U.S. Capitol sits is obviously called Capitol Hill. Interestingly, it's because the temple of Jupiter in Rome was built on the Capitoline Hill, so named because the Latin word for head, caput, when they were digging the foundation for the temple of Jupiter in the 6th century BC, the last king of Rome, Tarquinius Superbus, or Tarquin the Proud, was informed that they'd found a well-preserved human head probably a victim in one of their wars. This was taken as a good omen because in ancient Italy, you know, the Latins and the Etruscans believed that you communicated with the dead by talking to a skull.
Oh, wow.
So they decided to rename the hill from Mons Saturnus, or the Mount of Saturn, to the Capitoline Hill, the place of a skull, in other words.
Oh, wow.
And so the United States Capitol built there, the dome of the Capitol is inspired by the Pantheon in Rome, which was the temple that was built in Rome to honor all of the gods. At the top of the Pantheon is a hole, the oculus, which means the eye, open to the sky, represented the portal through which the spirit of Caesar would ascend to become one of the gods.
Wow.
Now, what do you have when inside the United States Capitol? When you look up from the rotunda, you see the oculus. It's not open to the sky, but it opens to a painting of George Washington among the gods.
Wow.
It's called the Apotheosis of Washington, George Washington becoming a deity. And I argue in the book that the symbolism there, the fact that Washington is sitting with his legs covered, wrapped in purple cloth, purple representing royalty in the ancient world, is similar to the way the statue of Saturn was depicted in the Temple of Saturn in Rome, where his legs were wrapped in wool, except during the Saturnalia, which was the 1 week of the year where it was believed Saturn was allowed out of Tartarus to party, and then wrapped up again and sent back down to the netherworld. This represents the new golden age into which George Washington, representing Saturn, would lead the United States. And I think it also represents the goal of this entity, Saturn, Kronos, Balamon, Shemiyaza, emerging from the netherworld and ascending to what he thinks is his rightful place in the heavens. Because when the Capitol was built in the early 18th century, there was a 10-foot hole that was left in the floor, a circular opening in the floor of the rotunda above a chamber off of the crypt, which is the first floor of the Capitol. George Washington's body was supposed to be kept there in that chamber so that people in the rotunda could look down through this portal, see Washington, and then look up through the oculus in the top of the Capitol dome. Now, the Brits burned the Capitol in 1814 as part of the War of 1812, or maybe it was 1813. But anyway, the Capitol was burned. It took years to repair it. And by the time they were ready to put the body of Washington in this chamber, Martha, who'd given permission, had passed on, and George's descendants said, no, we're going to honor George's will and keep him in Mount Vernon. Thank you very much.
Oh, so wow.
That hole has now been covered up, but that was the original design. That was the original design.
That's amazing.
When you look back at what happened on January 6th of 2020, and I will close with this, I think we can agree that what happened, whatever you want to call it, was not an insurrection, but the reaction of our political class to the riot at the Capitol on January 6th of 2020, consistently referred to over and over again as a sacred space that had been desecrated and defiled. Chuck Schumer, Senator Amy Klobuchar, Senator Dick Durbin, Nancy Pelosi, Representative Liz Cheney, all referred to this as our temple of democracy. The temple of democracy had been desecrated and defiled.
Wow.
Liz Cheney even called it the most sacred space in our democracy. Why would they consistently use this? Look, we do not have a temple of democracy, but apparently there are those in our government and among our media class who think that we do. That's how it was referred to. And I want to give this credit to Sharon. She pointed out that January 6th is the date celebrated in the Eastern Church, and well, Christians around the world, but especially in the Eastern Church, as the Epiphany. It is the day when, or Theophany in the Eastern Church. Epiphany is the day when the divinity of Jesus was acknowledged, was recognized by the wise men coming from the East. This is the day of that riot. And who led the riot? Coming back to the idea of the Titans and the buffalo, the oxen imagery of these old gods. The guy with the buffalo hat shaman.
Oh, yeah.
Led
the
rebellion. And get this, you can't make this up. His stage name, because he's an actor, his stage name is Jacob Angeli.
Wow.
And
oh, that gives me goosebumps.
The desecration of the temple of our democracy on the day when Christians around the world celebrate the recognition of the divinity of Jesus Christ. I think this is a nudge, nudge, wink, wink from the spirit realm. Hey, this old God is coming back, and they're looking forward to that day. Well, we'll talk about that in our next session.
Holy cow. Well, Derek, once again, the third week in a row, you just absolutely blow our mind with this information, and in tying these connections together is just, it's almost overwhelming. It's like you really do need to come back, go back and listen to it again. And I encourage everybody, you've really got to get this book. You really have to get the book in order to put all the pieces and parts, because of course, he's just kind of given us the highlights, the cliff notes of what this is all about and what the digging into it is and what it's really going to mean, which is what we're going to talk about in our next session, our fourth week, our last week, which makes me so sad, our fourth week to which will come next week on tying this all together. And what does this really mean in terms of end times? And what does it mean in our country in terms of prophecy and, you know, all these different things that we're tying together? So, Derek, thank you again so much. This was just like makes your head just want to swim and all that information and all of it. Now, and I'll say it to our listeners, you know, what is the one of the coolest things about me spending all this time with you and all this time with Doug Van Dorn and all this time, you know, with Doug Woodward is I feel like I get to stand on the shoulders of giants, on the shoulders of people who have spent years and putting all these things together. It sure saves me a lot of time that I don't have to feel like I got to do this, because I can graciously learn from and take all of your information and put it into context with the other things that I'm reading and studying about. So thank you so much for that. But before we close today, I just want to say one last thing about our sponsors for these special events. One of our main sponsors is MyPillow.com, which always has great discounts. You know, I know that Mike Lindell, who's a great patriot, has a lot of affiliates out there that that promoting MyPillow products helps to support this show, but it also helps to support Mike. There's more than 200 great products that are there. I mean, from doggy beds and slippers to sheets and pillowcases and robes, there's all kinds of things that are there. So if you are in line for getting some sort of a gift for someone, whether it be a birthday or a holiday or something like that, and you shop at mypillow.com, please be sure to use our affiliate code, which is DRT, as in Dr. Tenpenny, DRT, which gives you great discounts. Some of these discounts are up to almost 80% off. And if you're going to buy supplements, we encourage you to shop with us at shoptenpenny.com. Check out our private label supplements, the bottles with the white label, they're white bottles with little green leaves on them. And check out our private, when you check that out, those are really important. And during this special event and through the end of February, if you go and you shop at either shoptenpenny.com or you go to drtenpenny.com and you go to our apparel store through the end of February, all of our private label supplements and everything in the apparel store is 15% off with using the affiliate code Saturn. If you go to drtenpenny.com, you can find those things. And one other thing, Derek, tell them about your website and about the book deals and the special things that you've got going for just for this special event, so that they can get your book, because you really have to get this. But more importantly, they've got a bundle going now that you can get all of these books, because I could absolutely promise you, once you get one, you're going to want to get the rest of them. So tell people where they can go to your website and to get that incredible app that you offer.
Well, our website is gilberthouse.org, and there's links in the top menu bar there for pretty much everything. You'll find a link there for our app, which is available for mobile devices, also Roku and Apple TV. The mobile device, or the mobile app rather, has some advantages to it. It's got a Bible app, in fact, an audio Bible app, which is really cool. The developer of this app did a really great job. So that is a free download and available for iOS, Android, Amazon, Kindle Fire phones and tablets. Our store is linked there as well. And of course, the Second Coming of Saturn is available there. We've got a shortened URL. If you want to just write this down very quickly using bit.ly, which is that URL shortener, bit.ly, bit.ly/secondsaturn. That'll take you right to the Second Coming of Saturn. And everything that we sell through our store, Sharon and I, at least as far as the books go, we will sign those. So we're just honored that you would choose to support what we do through our store. And we've also got a collection of all five of my nonfiction books, which is The Great Inception, The Day the Earth Stands Still, about the UFO phenomenon and the supernatural forces behind it. The Bad Moon Rising, which is about Islam's role in the end times. Last Clash of the Titans, and of course, the Second Coming of Saturn. And you can get those for 30% off. That's $100 value for $70 plus shipping and handling. That's bit.ly/Saturn30. And that gets you 30% off on that collection.
And do you still have any spaces left for your tour in March?
We do some. We were getting people onto a third bus. This will be, but as of the last time we heard, there were maybe 15 slots left. And I know of four people who just contacted us yesterday as we're recording this. So, but there's still time left if people are interested in joining us in Israel. And we will take you to, boy, from north to south, we'll go to Mount Hermon. We'll be on the slopes of Mount Hermon. We will go out on the Sea of Galilee and explain how that relates to what we're discussing here. We'll show you the actual historic sites of the crucifixion and resurrection. And then if you join us for the extension over to Jordan, we'll go up Mount Nebo and explain why that was historically, but also prophetically significant. You can see the site of ancient Sodom from there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And what are the dates of your tour? When is this?
Begins March 15th and runs through March 19th through the 30th, March 19th through 30th, with the optional three-day extension tacked on to the end of that.
And they can find that at gilberthouse.org. They can find information about it and find out whether or not you sold out by the time we've got these all posted and everything. So that just sounds amazing. Everything that you do is amazing. In fact, I use their, I've got their app, and you get these little notifications every day, when it's time to listen to you guys. So it's really great. The notifications are great because you're in the middle of doing whatever you're doing and it makes you stop. And you get to go and listen to whatever you and Sharon are talking about that day, which is always amazing. So I want to thank you, Derek Gilbert, for all the stuff that you're bringing for us. And this is part three. We've got one part left, which kind of wraps it all up and pulls it together. It makes me really sad because I've really enjoyed these things so much. And so go to the site. If you missed part one and you missed part two, you can go to drtenpenny.com/Saturn. And they're posted there that you can listen to them. There's Michelle put together a really great page that you can listen to them. I think there's also the Bitly links are attached on that page where you can go and get the 30% off the bundle and go and get directly the Second Coming of Saturn. So with that, thank you again so much, Derek. And I always close every single one of my podcasts, whether they're pre-recorded or whether they're live, with one of my favorite verses, which is Romans 12:12. Rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. And so until the next time, remember to lean into God, trust him for everything. He will never let you down. Thank you again so much, everyone. And we'll see you next week. Thank you again, Derek. Take care. We'll talk again real soon.